I'm an astrophysicist, so I use astrophysical tools as opposed to quantum tools. So this is, I guess you could say, it's an astrophysical solution. An astrophysicist, yeah, like fluids, of course, and so this heavily depends on fluids. So this is a long list of collaborators, and many of them are working with Michael Ballack at the University, Tom Gibbon is here, Ben and Foster at Utrecht, Casanova Ricordi, Lancaster, Chanda Prescott Weinstein, a grad student I'm working in the first row. And if you want to ask hard questions, go to Portugal. I answer easy questions. And Doug Roberts is a student moving back to FPI as a postdoc, and Andrew Tall is just here. So these are the two papers that are out on this, and there are many more work on in progress. So this is the outline of the talk, and don't hesitate to interrupt me at any point. So I'm going to tell you a bit about the cosmological constant problem, and of course you all are too familiar with it being at this meeting. But this is it's going to be a very brief introduction. Then I'm going to tell you about this idea of gravitational ether, which is, I wonder if we can turn down the light. I think this background doesn't go very well. Anyway. Yeah, it should not be turned anything black. So there is a way to get rid of the quantum vacuum through this mechanism. I'm going to tell you a little bit about how it could be related to quantum gravity through the idea of discrete clocks. And then there are lots of quantum astrophysical tests of this. And one amazing prediction of this, we were surprised by it, is that, as you said, I'm an astrophysicist, you can tie a stellar black hole to cosmic acceleration through this procedure. And of course, it's not a complete picture. There are lots of missing links that maybe some of you can feel. So, this is the cosmological constant conundrum. All of you know that there are many aspects to it. So whichever part you try to solve, the other parts may go wrong. So there's the old cosmological constant problem, as John eloquently summarized for us, goes back to Pauli's time. Why don't we see quantum vacuum fluctuations? There's the new cosmological constant problem, which is some 10 years old, or well, maybe Gene Peebles would say maybe 15 years. So there have been discrepancies that could be explained by cosmological constant even back in the 90s. So there is actually, it's not zero. We do see some trace of the vacuum fluctuations. And then there's a coincidence problem. And there are several versions of it, but the easiest, one of them is that why does the structure formation happen around the same time that landed on it? And all of these aspects should be ultimately related to some UV complete quantum gravity model. It's not clear whether there should be a connection, but of course, if you have a theory of everything, then that's going to explain everything. And what I'm going to try to convince you about is that a component, an incompressible fluid, which I call it different things at different times, gravitational ether or Coscutum, is an ingredient that in principle can address all of these issues, because it's not going to solve everything, but it's an ingredient that seems to be present in a rather consistent solution to all these aspects. So, and I understand that I'm being very, very controversial, so don't hesitate to stop me. So this is, of course, the most very good way of putting the cosmological constant problem. On cosmological scale, if you believe in Einstein equation, you can calculate the left-hand side, or you observe the left-hand side, and this is observation of lambda. And you can calculate the right-hand side from the standard model. That's what John presented to us. So this is a statement of some classical gravity, which is our best description of gravity, because we cannot quantize gravity. We can't quantize, of course, matter very well. And this is the expectation value of T mu nu. So left-hand side is classical, right-hand side is a quantum mechanical, which you take the expectation value of. And this is much bigger than this, 56 orders of magnitude. Yes?
Can And Higgs potential is classical.
Yes, so that's, you're right. Sorry, so John. So there are classical additions to this. That's right, absolutely. So there are classical additions that add on top of this quantum and are comparable, absolutely. So the only known solution, and of course many wouldn't consider this solution, many people in this audience, is that you have lots of possibilities, lots of, you add a random number that could take anything, and then you have some anthropic reasoning for why this sum takes the value that it takes. The only, if you want to be fair, I think really the only criticism is that it's not really falsifiable, at least as it's presented. And maybe if you have a theory of everything, you can come up with falsified predictions of that theory, yeah, and then there will be anthropic, but at the level that it stands, it's not falsifiable.
Well, thank you, for coming.
Yes, sir.
I think the real weakness of the anthropic principle, whether or not it's falsifiable or verifiable, the real weakness is it doesn't explain anything. It's not explanatory. One should distinguish a prediction from an explanation.
Well, that's a different. Yeah, I mean, okay. So at the level that why Earth is buried at this at the current distance from the sun, yes, you don't predict it, but it's. Well, I mean, I don't know. Maybe that's the fact that the physics was developed after the life was developed. I don't know. If it was the other way around, you could have predicted, maybe. But I think at that level, there is an environmental dependence. Everybody knows this. Earth is not too far from the sun, and it's not too close from the sun for a reason. The same could be for the universe. The difference is that you can observe other solar systems, but you cannot observe other universes. And I think that's really what makes it so different. But this is a back call.
Yeah, I shouldn't have read it.
Yes. So, yeah, short of this, I think the strongest motivation for modifying that. If you don't have this selection rules, selection criteria, then this equation cannot be correct. So actually, yes, so parameter is very fertile ground for solving it, as much as you might have noticed by now. So I had only two of them, but actually you've heard a lot more. So you've heard about two extra dimensional variant solutions. So the first day you heard from Cliff Burgess and his collaborators about a co-dimensional two-brain. So basically what happens is that you live on this brain, and there's a huge lambda, but it only carries extra dimensions. And extra dimensions are about 10 millimeters, 10 microns long, and there are lots of predictions that can be tested either by precision tests of gravity or cosmologically. But the theory needs a lot more to be forecast fully. And the second solution also relies on the extra dimensions, but it's a bit more exotic because it has exotic gravity terms or induced gravity terms. For our brain, the brain that we live in, as well as other brains that we happen to be embedded in. And lots of people here have worked on it as well. And Justin and Basil and others talked about it. So, this basically what they do, so I'm not going to tell you much about them, and you've heard lots of great talks about them, but so the great achievement and success of these models is that they suppress that their lambda in a technically natural way. So if you add quantum corrections at high energies, they don't necessarily affect what we observe on the scale. So quantum corrections are decoupled from observations. Say quantum gravity or any UV composition that we're not aware of. And they're very testable if they are fully developed. And for example, Cliff Stark or Gazal Stark, they both talked about the tests of these models. So this was much, they're very different from anthropic and landscape ideas. Now, there are some drawbacks to these models, though. They don't solve the coincidence problem, if you consider it a problem. Why does the structure formation coincide with domination of lambda or observation of acceleration? And a different problem, which you may like it or not, it's not really a problem, but maybe an attractiveness of the model. So you're replacing one anomalously small parameter with infinite number of dynamical variables, which is basically these extra dimensions. So you have to come up with mechanisms to tune these extra variables, this infinite number of extra variables. So there'll be memory effects and question of initial conditions. You might have something like inflation to fix it or some other mechanism. And the nature might prefer this. This is nothing wrong. It's just a question of economy, basically. How many new variables or structures are you willing to introduce to the theory? Of course, these are all testable, so you can test it, and these theories may be confirmed, but you are adding all this new structure to the theory, basically these extra dimensions. So what I'm going to do in the next 20 minutes or so is I'm going to introduce a degravitation model, basically a model to decouple quantum vacuum fluctuations from gravity with no extra free parameters or dynamical degree of freedom. So in terms of model economy, you may think that it might be more attractive, but it has its own problem. So here's the alternative, and it's very simple-minded. So the problem in gravity, or in cosmological constant problem, is that the vacuum fluctuations are proportional to g mu nu. So t mu nu is the vacuum part plus excitation. Of course, we see excitations. The excitations do gravitate. But this vacuum part is huge and we don't see it. So why don't we just subtract the trace of t mu nu from the right-hand side? So that sounds like a reasonable way of going about it. And so now any vacuum, no matter what it is, how big it doesn't gravitate. And this is completely classical. Or you can think of it at the semi-classical level, that expectation value is on the right-hand side. Now, of course, there's an obvious problem with this. If you have to satisfy Bianchi identity, and g mu nu has zero divergence from basic differential geometry, you know that t mu nu, if you want to have equivalence principle, t mu nu is conserved, but this term doesn't have zero divergence. So there are these three dots have to basically cancel the divergence stack. So they call that the rest t prime mu nu. And basically the divergence of this t prime should cancel the divergence. So you may think, I haven't really solved the problem, I just remove the problem from here to here, or move the problem from here to here. And of course, if I make a hypothesis for how t prime mu should look like, and at the consistent way of solving it, then at least I have solved the problem at the classical level. Quantum mechanically, at the level of quantum gravity, I don't really know what's going to happen. But at the semi-classical level, that this addresses the problem, or can potentially do it. And this is the astrophysics part that comes in. So I hypothesized a perfect fluid form for t prime mu. And furthermore, I hypothesized that it has zero density but the managing pressure. And it turns out this is the perfect fluid, basically by analogy to fluid mechanics, you can show that this equation is enough basically to solve it, or to solve the initial value problem. Basically, this problem is similar to solving the Euler equation, at least at the perturbative level, similar to solving the Euler equation with some non-vanishing source. So you have Einstein equation with some source, and you don't have to solve Einstein equation, and you have the Euler equation for this component, although it's a bit weird because this component has zero density. But you can always look at the limit that zero density approaches zero. So it's basically fluid mechanics plus Einstein equation. Now, what's especially attractive about this particular form, or the incompressible limit, is that tests of gravity severely constrain new degrees of freedom. Because you don't see fixed forces, and also say pulsar timing, you know that you're not emitting new degrees of freedom because the predictions of general relativity are very consistent with pulsar timing the emission of gravitational wave. So it's any new degree of freedom that I introduce to gravity is going to be severely constrained, and it must be a small fine-tuning parameters because all the tests of gravity fail to see these new degrees of freedom. And this is the only model that I know of that doesn't have new degrees of freedom. So that's the statement. So here's here's a bit about the origin of that model, which we worked on a while back. So imagine a discrete Koch field. Imagine that a field space with Kochs, and they tick a discrete way. So tick, 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 tick. So it's continuous in a space, but it ticks discretely. So we wanted to think about it as a tunneling process, but that's maybe not a good idea. The idea is just that you have to think of a time or a some field which has discrete degrees of freedom. So here you have one value, say it's 1 second, it's 2 second, 3 second, etc. So it's continuous in the space, but has this is discrete in time in a sense. So you have basically a clock field. Now you can imagine that low energy is the most general if these are smooth enough, these surfaces. And of course, these are going to be a space log because this is a time variable. The most general action that you can think of for this system, so you, I have my covariance, my space time, of course, but this field has discrete dynamics. That's really the only discreteness here. The most general geometric action that you can write here is the sum of terms that are proportional to the surface areas of these interfaces, plus a term that's proportional to, these, to the volumes of these regions. So this is going to be the surface area term, the sum over the surface areas, and this is going to be a sum over volumes. And in the continuous limit, when you have many kicks in your clock, you can actually show that this reduces to what we call the Kaskuten action, which I'm going to explain to you where it comes from. But in the continuous limit, when you have lots of these phis, this gives you a square root of d mu phi minus some potential. So this is just the surface there, which is interfaces. And this is the VR phi. And as you say, by construction, this doesn't have a dynamical degree of freedom because it comes from a discrete field. Okay? Now, as I told you, to my knowledge, this is the only possible modification, this is the only modification of gravity that we've seen that does not introduce, at least in the infrared, that does not introduce new perturbative degrees of freedom.
When you said the continuum limit, it looked like it had a field.
It does look like it has a field, but it doesn't have dynamics in the sense that it's the field equation, and I think, yeah.
Yeah, you're supposed to have this.
Well,
I don't know.
You were supposed to ask all the best questions, so. That's good, yeah. So the field equation becomes a constraint equation here. So the field doesn't really have any dynamics. It's just a constraint. Or you could, at the perturbative level, you can also show that the momentum conjugate to the field vanishes. So in that sense, it doesn't have a dynamics. So that makes it the perfect candidate to modify GR because we don't happen to see any degree of freedom in our test of any new degree of freedom in our test of gravity. And this is where the name comes from. So this is a parasitic plant called Cascuta. It's a Latin name, the actual name is Dodder. And the idea is that this doesn't have its own dynamic, only couples to something. So it's a parasite. And what Andrew yeah, well, that's completely coincidental. No actual connection between the parasite. Okay, so what Andrew showed, so Andrew and I managed to show is that actually at the classical level, this Horaba-Lipschitz gravity, which is a very hot claim that for UV completion of gravity by breaking Lorentz invariance, is actually the quadratic Kaskuten model, Kaskuten with a quadratic potential at low energy. And this, in case you haven't seen it, this is a paper that came out back in January, and I think by now has more than 50 citations. And yes, so it's a hot topic, and the claim is that this is the way to quantize gravity, or in UV completely, or in a denormalizable way, that basically. So it's power counting denormalizable. And it turns out that low energies, basically the action, it looks very complicated. It's actually the Kaskuten action, GR plus the Kaskuten action. And back a few years ago, we actually, even from observations, we constrained this lambda in the theory. Basically, mu to the 4 divided by ms squared is lambda in this, lambda minus 1 in this theory, which is less than 1% at 95% confidence level, based on CMD and other constraints. So this theory for lambda other than 1 predicts a running of Planck mass on the horizon scale. The sub-horizon Planck mass is different from super-horizon Planck mass. But this is not really beyond the point. That this is really a motivation study that this kind of field, this discrete cockfield, might even help you quantizing gravity. That's why they're interesting.
The Hajar-Rao model?
Trace K.
Trace K, yeah.
So basically, you integrate out phi and you pick up a trace K square term, and that gives you the lambda K square.
So this is all I have about quantum gravity. This is not really much, but it's just really motivation for why these incompressible fluids could be interesting for different purposes. So now I'm going to go back to the theory that I introduced to you. Basically, G mu nu. So the theory is G mu nu is T mu nu, or the transverse part of T mu nu, plus plus a Coase-Gouffin field. So this is the theory I'm going to stick to for the rest of the talk. And this has infinite speed of sum, no dynamical degree of freedom. So you can do the Friedmann equation. And so you have a rho effective on the right-hand side, which you have to subtract the trace. And T prime, there is no zero-zero component to it because it doesn't have any density. So what you get is that rho effective is proportional to 1 plus W. And there's a 3/4 which you can absorb in the definition of G Newton. So what you basically get is that you could say the rho effective or G effective is proportional to 1 plus W in this theory. So effective G depends on the equation of a state of what's gravitating. And one obvious prediction that comes in cosmology is that G Newton for non-relativistic matter divided by G for radiation is a factor of 3/4. And in GR, obviously, this is 1. There's a universal G. Independent. So there would be a transition from 3/4 to 1, basically. So
it's a continuous.
Yes, it's a continuous. But for cosmology, you can do it exactly, yes.
So what happens if you have an electron crossing the Earth? Right? I mean, not
but so those are
relativistic. There is a difference, right?
So then this is not a good description. So this is only for a homogeneous universe. If you have an inhomogeneous situation, you have this fluid that you have to solve for. Basically, there's a constraint for T prime meter. So if you have a combination of things that are inhomogeneous, there is no simple description that the gravity.
Well, you were just referring to precision tests that allow additional degrees of freedom.
Yes.
And I'm trying to put your model to the same test.
Yes.
You got to look at what happens, in within the solar system.
Absolutely.
You're telling that there is no good description.
No, there is good description, but this is not it. I mean, this is just homogeneous cosmology, and there will be description for different situations. So there will be exact or approximate description of this in non-relativistic situations and in homogeneous situations. So anything that's in between these two is not going to be easy to predict. But it happens that all the,
1 over C corrections are going to be different.
Well, we see.
But you just said that, right? That for ultra-relativistic particles, you have a different gravity than for.
No, it's a covariant. A particle is moving fast. You can always go to its rest frame, and it's not moving. So it's really relative velocities that matter, not individual velocities. So I'm going to come back to this, but Justin.
Yeah, I have one more basic question. Yeah. So this equation you wrote down. Mm-hmm. The covariant. Do you derive this from your action, from Einstein-Hilbert plus your Coase-Gouffin action?
No, there is no. No, I don't.
It's just cannot be obtained from.
That's right. So that's what I'm going to come back to, and that's really the only drawback. I have my reasons why it's not too bad. But yes, so Coase-Gouffin. If you didn't have the coupling to matter, then it is okay. But, sorry, this is not. All right. So this is minus T G mean. But that's really, so at the level of classical gravity, I don't think I have to have an action. Yes.
I find that still.
Okay. I understand, yeah.
Is this the trick water for Cambridge or BBN?
I'm sorry, what is that?
The trick water.
So that's the next, that's the next step. So so BBN puts this at about 2 sigma level, 2.5 sigma level, and consistent with this. It's interesting, though, that's the whole, and I'm going to come back to this. That's not the whole story. We just look at Lyman alpha first from plus W map 3, and there's a way you can translate this to the number of neutrinos, which I can come back to. This is exactly consistent. So there are different data sets that tell you actually different things. They're inconsistent at the level of 2 sigma level, but CMB and Lyman alpha forest actually prefer this value, and BBN not so much. But actually, BBN has its own problems. So this is actually the constraint that I was given, has calculated. On G Newton divided by G radiation as a function of eta, this is baryon to photon ratio. And WMAP constrains things very much in this direction. So there's just this thin strip here. And the rest are different constraints. And I guess WMAP itself doesn't have much constraint on GCMB. So it's consistent for both the value from ether, which is here at 0.75, and the value for matter. And value for general relativity. But then the different BBN constraints put you at different places. So helium, which is the one that actually people usually quote, is, as I said, inconsistent at 2.5 sigma level with gravitational ether, and that's those red lines. But actually, lithium, with general relativity or standard theory, has a hard time explaining. You are basically this gravitational ether model is within a 2 sigma region allowed by the lithium observation. So that's this green region. And general relativity, I think, as 3 to 5 sigma level has problem explaining. General relativity with the standard number of neutrinos and everything is standard. And of course, there's a lot of activity in the particle physics community to come up with non-standard models that could explain this.
Sort of contentious issues. What about deuterium?
So deuterium is this blue thing. So it doesn't.
So you both are consistent, basically, because it doesn't really constrain the this ratio very much. At least it seems, according to this plot.
Yeah. So at the 2 sigma level, I'd say both are consistent. So
what people usually say that BBN constrains this ratio. That's one, at least if you just put all the data together, it seems that that's not quite correct. At least at the 3 sigma level, everything is consistent. But if you want at the 2 sigma level, lithium prefers the ether model and helium prefers the general relativity. So now we have two pieces of evidence that support this, other than the cosmological constant. Sorry, go ahead.
I have a basic question about
sure.
This idea of having a non-dynamical degree of freedom. You know, one way to think about it is, you know, really the degree of freedom have is dynamical, but let's say I put a quadratic term to it, I'm just dialing down the coefficient of the sending that coefficient to zero.
So that's like sending a speed of sound to infinity. It's large, but not
right. Long. And now when I do that, one way to think about it is, well, let me actually make a field redefinition to make my quadratic term actually canonical. And in some sense, basically, you will end up having a field which is basically strongly coupled. We have very low effective cutoff. It's kind of analogous to, I think, what Sean Carroll called modified source gravity, which is similar in spirit.
That's not true. Modified source gravity doesn't spontaneously break through and survive. Basically, all you can do, if you just integrate the scalar field, you find a modified matter Lagrangian. I wouldn't call it even modified gravity, the modified source gravity.
Modified source gravity is worse than that. It just doesn't make sense because it tells you that the electron is strongly coupled from the limit.
So the question I have.
But that's what he's asking you.
Do you have the same problem? Do you have the same problem?
But no. Because this doesn't, you cannot integrate out this field. At least not not complete. I mean, you can look at perturbations, but perturbations don't even have are not dynamical, so they are just fixed by a constraint. So they you can, I don't know. So it's like introducing out a constraint. I don't think actually you can do it. So
it's a bit contentious because there may be an issue of order of limits.
So let me go on because I have to finish and I have some a bit more on my plate, including explaining acceleration of the universe.
I'm just saying, that's the right question, and you have the same thing in the Royal Lipschitz thing. The only thing that might save you is there might still be some symmetry that protects you against generating the extra kinetic term. So if you have a non-dynamical thing that is protected by some symmetry, then
what is that symmetry?
But there is the Royal Lipschitz thing. There is. So that's complicated.
So we should discuss that later. But just to reiterate what I said,
if you just include W map 5 and lambda of Paris, in our theory, this is the constraint that you get. WMAP 5 itself doesn't really distinguish between the two, and if you add lambda alpha forest.
Forest data, yes, I would be very careful.
Yeah.
It assumes that there are no other sources of fluctuations in the H1.
Yeah.
But dark matter, right? I mean,
but
the problem is the amplitude of lambda alpha is higher than you expect, and people doing the analysis ignore energy input from helium reionization.
Well,
so it's,
I talk to people who do it, and they say that if you do add it, it doesn't make a difference. And so I think I'm yet to see a paper that shows concretely that that's a problem. But I agree. So this is...
Yeah, all for Frontano, all for Lonetto and Bolton.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I would just put a bigger error bar on it.
Okay, maybe. So it is already at the two-sig model, but...
The mean is good, so that. But the matrix is systematic. So yes, that's true. Of course, this is at about 2 sigma level. But remember where we started from. We started from a 10^120 sigma discrepancy, and that's much more. That's a much more solid observation than this. Yeah.
Addition to what David said, even the data itself tells you that the power spectrum in the forest is actually correlated with how noisy, how faint the quasar is actually. The fainter the quasars, the higher the power, which suggests probably there's a problem with the data itself.
Okay, so you tell them to the Islam people. They like that. So. But okay, so there are lots of all of these observations, Big Bang consensus, lambda alpha should be taken with a grain of salt, and I couldn't agree more. So there, I have a couple of studies about non-relativistic perturbations, but since Maxime has stepped out, and I just don't have to say them. So, but the gist is that there is a mechanism. That as long as you don't have non-relativistic pressure, what happens is that if you go to the rest frame of matter, the longitudinal modes vanish. So basically, if you forget about rotation, ether follows matter, because actually ether was sourced by matter. There could be rotation, so the ether and matter could rotate with respect to each other, and that could be an observational check of this model. So it's called the gravitomagnetic, this local gravitomagnetic effect. And so this is a statement. And of course, if this argument that I told you holds absent rotation, ether follows matter, and all that's what happens basically in that case, that there's a G effective that goes as 1 plus W times G, as long as ether follows matter. And that's for non-relativistic matter. For relativistic matter, ether doesn't care about this. And when I say relativistic, I mean relativistic pressure. The only thing that's constrained, and this is a terrible choice of color, is a PPN parameter that's not constrained by observation. So I think this theory is fine with the precision test of gravity. And this is what I just told you. There are two possible deviations. One is rotation, so if gravity probe B sees the effect of rotation of Earth, that's going to be the test because ether doesn't rotate. An internal structure of relativistic objects like neutron stars or supernovae, that's going to be different. But those are not very well constrained from astrophysics. So
that's obviously a place that can discount this.
Gravity from P?
So basically, there would be order one deviation in the, or maybe 30% deviation in the effect of rotation, the gravitational effect of rotation of Earth. So I don't really know how much, well, I don't really have much time. And the chair is stepped out, so maybe I have enough in that. Indefinite amount. Okay, there you are. Okay. There you are. Okay. So the physical theories should have an action, and that's a requirement that I think probably of everybody who talked at this meeting has adhered to. And I want to just say that maybe that's the reason that we had a hard time coming up with the solution, at least at the effective level. Now, the classical theories don't need an action. And there is a simple reason for that, that actually Andrew told me once, that coarse grain theories have information loss. So that means that the evolution is not unitary. So that by definition, they don't have action. Because if you are far away from the coarse graining, the coarse graining doesn't matter, then it's not a problem. But by definition, if you coarse grain something and you lose information due to coarse graining, then you cannot have an action. And this happens a lot in fluid mechanics, which is my background. So the viscosity, turbulence, diffusion, they cannot be described by an action principle because you have loss of information. So gravity action is only necessary if you want to quantize gravity. So as long as you stay away from a region that you need quantum gravity, then you might be fine. And in contrast, the model that describes quantum field theory in classical Kramer spacetime, that's the model that you're sticking to. And I cannot hide the fact that this is really the biggest hurdle. Lack of an action is the biggest hurdle for UV completion of the theory. But I think as long as you're dealing with classical gravity, it seems to be the case in cosmology and precision tests. It's okay. But of course, that's the big challenge. Can you write an action? But if it works in any other respect except for not having an action, that's one. I think I prepare data to principle. So this is, I'm sorry I'm running a slow, although I guess it was partly ruffled. Well, so I have still 5 minutes according to my thought. So this is the amazing thing, that's the next prediction that came out of this theory, which is very surprising. You can just solve, there is no matter in the theory, ether, of course, part of the gravity, and you have Einstein equation. You can try to solve for Schwarzschild solution in the presence of ether, and this is the kind of solution that you get. It looks like Schwarzschild, e to the phi is the Schwarzschild part, but there is this correction, 1 plus p naught times a constant, where p naught is an integration constant, which basically is proportional to the pressure of ether. So this is basically a hydrostatic equilibrium for a zero density fluid. And so this is fine. If p naught is zero, you'd have Schwarzschild solution, which is a consistent solution. So ether, one consistent solution is that there is no ether. That's fine. But the striking behavior of this f of r is that it actually diverges both close to the horizon of the black hole and far from the horizon of a black hole. So there is the same integration constant that controls behavior far from the horizon and close to the horizon of the black hole. So this is how it looks like. So there is and it changes sign as well. So f of r, which is this function that characterizes deviation from Schwarzschild, somewhere around three times the horizon radius, crosses zero, but diverges as you go far away from the horizon and very close to the horizon. So the same integration constant controls behavior at both spheres, cosmological spheres and close to the horizon. So this is a UV-IR coupling that you would never actually expect in any other theory, and you have never seen in other theory. So there is always this assumption of decoupling, which doesn't hold here. And there is an interesting coincidence of numbers. You would think it's numerology, but somehow everything works out. That if you include that correction, at the Schwarzschild radius, redshift doesn't go to infinity anymore. It goes to a maximum, which is goes as 1 over p naught times m squared. Of course, if p naught is 0, it's infinite redshift by definition. And if somehow you assume some quantum gravity effect, say we call it a Trans-Planckian ansatz, but basically if you assume quantum gravity effects kick in and fix these corrections a Planck length away from the horizon, or another way of putting it is that the maximum redshift at the Schwarzschild radius is Planck energy divided by Hawking temperature, then this assumption fixes the value of this integration constant to be something that's at first negative, and second goes as 1 over m cubed, and happens to be the observed density of dark energy for 7e solar mass. So that's a coincidence. So maybe that's all we need. Of course, this is still far away from complete solution, but this is a simple situation, or maybe the simplest situation other than a homogeneous universe that you can imagine. Well, so that's a different question. How do you add all these different black holes together? This is the only one black hole. Now, so this is interesting suggestion that maybe formation of a stellar black holes can trigger late time cosmic acceleration. Sure. So for a star, you actually never reach this maximum redshift, basically. So there is.
No, I'm just saying, take a star. What's your FOBAR outside the
FOBAR is the same. FOBAR is the same for all spirit. It's just the integration constant. Thing is that P naught is an integration constant that would be fixed by the boundary conditions and infinity in principle. It's just that. So the proposal here is that whenever you have a horizon, you have a mechanism that fixes P naught. That fixes pressure of ether. If you don't have a horizon, then this is just an integration constant that is basically exactly the same as the constant in pressure, basically. So when you solve for static equilibrium, there is always a constant pressure you can have. And that's fixed by boundary condition. So what we are proposing here is that this boundary condition is actually not fixed at infinity if you have a horizon. It's actually fixed on the horizons of the black hole. So that's really the Trans-Planckian ansatz.
But you're saying for a star, you wouldn't see any deviation from general relativity?
Well, if P naught is small, and if P naught is as small as this proposes, this is like a lambda, essentially. So it's, you don't see anything. So the deviations for a black hole are only a Planck length away from the black hole horizon or at cosmological distances. And this is how it's going to look like. So this is the deviations at large distances for, say, one solar mass, 10 solar mass, 100 solar mass. The small distances, these are tiny, and as you reach, depending on the mass, as you reach cosmological distances, they become a order. And this also blows up a Planck length away from the horizon, and you wouldn't see it in this scale.
This is probably a stupid question.
Yes.
What about the Nicholson-Morley experiment? Is never detected in ether?
But that's because the question is how does photon couple to the ether? And the hypothesis is that you have a covariance principle, matter only couples sees g mu nu. So that's the hard part about writing an action for this, because somehow gravity sees this ether, but matter doesn't see the ether. And that's the hard part about it. But at the classical level, at the semi-classical level, it makes sense. You only couple matter to g mu nu. But gravity, classically, always is a question.
That's not completely true. Your Young identity tells you that your ether bends under the rate of matter that propagates on top of it. Light doesn't bend it because it's scale invariant, but other stuff.
But that's the thing. So that's the weird thing about this.
It's not a preferred frame, but it's an interesting thing.
But ether sees matter, but matter doesn't see ether. So you would think that. So that you would think that doesn't fit in an action principle, which might well be what's happening. But I mean, there will be more than what's inside. But I have to finish, and I just want to leave you with interesting possibility. I have a few slides on this, but actually the action that these corrections do look like the Sitter spaces, large distances, in the sense that this is a Sitter metric, and this is a the solution that I get by solving Einstein equation in a spherical symmetric vacuum. And if you look at this and stare at it far from the horizon of the black hole,
but a smaller radius than the cosmological horizon. These two basically look the same to some because basically this, if you are away from the cosmological horizon, this term is a small. So with the right, if P0 is the same as rho lambda, this is a small. So these both grow as R squared. And this is the only term that sets the Newtonian potential. You see, Newtonian potential is what particles see. So all the particles around the black hole only really see this term. And to the particles around the black hole, the universe looks like a Deciter space, so they accelerate away from the black hole the same way that they would in a Deciter space. And of course, in the whole universe, this metric breaks down because this is for an empty space. So you can write this down around every individual black hole, but the whole universe, you have to somehow manage to patch these together. And that's going to be much more complicated. But this simple argument based on homogeneity tells you that you should get this Deciter space, because particles accelerate away from the center like they would in a Deciter space. So that's the argument. So that's, as this happens around every black hole, the coarse strain universe should look like a Deciter space. And of course, here I'm ignoring matter, so I'm getting Deciter space with the right scale. And I should finish. I'm, I think, more than a couple of minutes overdue. So basically, this is the question to Neumannian's answer. Sorry, this is the answer to Neumannian's question. Thank you, Jeopardy here. So there is an effective mass. If you have lots of black holes, we have basically we can at least with some approximation solve for the metric, and there is an effective mass that enters that formula. That's basically the mass-weighted geometric mean of the mass of the black hole. Basically, log of m star is average of log of m, which this average is mass-weighted. And then rho dark energy would go as 1 over m star. Effective dark energy goes as 1 over m star cubed. So as you accrete matter into black holes, m star increases, so your dark energy effectively goes down. So this is what calculation that Michael Ballo has done with the stars and supermassive black holes. So the average basically mass of the black holes of the universe, depending on the model, would increase basically because you have accretion into the black hole. And that gives you the evolution for dark energy. And some of the models are ruled out based on the star formation AGM. But the canonical model is just on the verge of being tested. And of course, these are the constraints, these regions from Matsu et al. 2008 paper. You can ask David about that paper. So this is it. So we have sharp predictions based on the star formation and AGN models. And they can be tested. They haven't quite been ruled out. Some of them are. But we don't understand the star formation and AGN activity as well as we would like to. If we do that, and these are all constrained by observations, there will be better constraints. We can test this model. But this is the main prediction, that if you understand black hole history in the universe, it's related to dark energy, and through the factor of order one, actually. So this is basically the end of the talk. I just want to summarize for you what we have achieved, which is, I think it's quite a lot, but of course there are lots of missing links, and we have abandoned some of the things that physicists have held dear for centuries. Particularly an action principle. But of course, action principle hasn't kept physicists in the 19th century from writing fluid equations. So maybe it's not too bad. So we can decouple gravity from vacuum energy by introducing an incompressible gravitational ether. So that's really the minor motivation here. So that's 10 to the 120 sigma observation that's in support of this. So this ether component is actually something that comes about in a possible UV completion of gravity. So these are not as crazy as you may think, these incompressible fluids. The sharp prediction of this model, and you realize I don't have any free parameter in the model, at least not at this level, is that G matter divided by J radiation is 3/4. So this will be test. This is all, I think most data prefer it except for helium 4. As I told you. Of course, all of these data sets have their own issues.
And the most interesting thing that I hope I managed to get you excited about is the fact that within, in the context of this model, you can basically tie physics close to the horizon of astrophysical black holes to cosmology that could explain later cosmic acceleration. And I think it can satisfy tests of general relativity as far as they exist. But this point I cannot vouch for as much as the rest of these points. So this is, I think, what we've achieved, which I think is a lot. But you require a classical theory. So that's what many physicists and just may not be willing to do yet. But astrophysicists, I know, are OK with classical theories. So this is the thing that can be done and should be done at a theoretical and observational level. So CMB and larger scale structure will have 10 times better accurate precision to measure this. So I think within 10 year time frame, this will be tested and ruled out for country. Precision test of gravity, say rotation of Earth. If we can confirm our prediction, so I'm not completely sure, but it seems that ether doesn't rotate, but matter does. So this dragging wouldn't work for rotation. So if you see a gravitational effect of rotation to better than 10% level, that's going to confirm or rule out the theory. So there will be a correlation between a star formation and GN activity and cosmic acceleration. And this can be tested with all the future generation of dark energy tests, because we can't see a GN and a star formation. And we are going to be able to measure cosmic acceleration at higher redshift. So this is another way to confirm or rule out the theory. And of course, the biggest theoretical question for relevant to most people for this room is that, is there a fundamental theory or action? And I couldn't come up with any obvious ones. The problem is it's not an easy task, but I know people here are much smarter than I am. So maybe there is a way to find it an action principle that is approximately reproduces this dynamics. And of course, this might shed light on quantum gravity eventually. And the ether is a preferred frame, so maybe it has something to do with ideas of emergent gravity or quantum gravity. So I'm going to leave you with these two questions, which are, first, should we revisit our assumptions for constructing effective theories? And that has guided us for past 50 years or so, at least, and have been extremely successful in particle physics. But in cosmology, maybe there are different kinds of effective theories. And in particular, I'm going to emphasize Rafael's point that locality might be the thing that is the key here, and then maybe the action principle somehow. And of course, the point I want to emphasize Rafael's point that maybe this cosmic acceleration is the first evidence for quantum gravity. And this is a very explicit way of seeing it in this model. Finally, should we reevaluate our dark energy program to basically see what theories that are well motivated to do? Thank you.
Quantum fluctuations of the clocks have eaten up some of the question time, but you know, have some of the question time.
There is a thermological action principle for fluids, first published by Gerald Thomas. There's a whole literature.
That's not the problem. The problem is the coupling to matter. So this kind of coupling, if there was no matter, then I could write an action. It's because photon action plus T. This sort of coupling to matter, that's the part that I have a hard time getting.
So Justin? Yeah, so I had a very simple worry, right? So if I have a star collapses into a black hole and I'm sitting far away,
yeah,
I'll feel, because you don't have a dynamical degree of freedom, so immediately I see the gravitational field changing before I actually observe the star.
But there is gravity has dynamical degree of freedom. There is gravitational wave.
Just from the form of your metric, the FLR term, if I could measure.
But that's a static metric. So I don't really
there's
know.
There's no dynamical degree of freedom. So it means that when the star collapses, the FLR, which comes from the ether, must change instantaneously.
And that
collapse is a slow process. You should be able to adiabatically move this.
Well, maybe. I mean, think that there is no perturbative dynamically. There could be non-perturbative. There could be a front that propagates when you form a black hole. So you see, I don't really know the answer to that question, but I can imagine answers of this sort. And since black hole formation is not a perturbative process, you could have a non-perturbative
degree of freedom that propagates like a front, rather than, so it wouldn't be, there could be propagation, it's just not perturbative.
No, but I think it's, I mean, it's the manual says it's going to be an adiabatic process.
But the formation of the horizon image.
It's perturbative by definition.
But it's, no, it's not. See, the thing is that.
Don't forget horizon. I'm simply telling you, take a star, okay?
Yeah.
And let it implode, okay? Initial stages are always slow.
Yeah, that's fine. But then when you form the horizon, that's
oh, but that, that's already, no, forget horizon. It takes you a while before
yeah.
you get to horizon. Just talk about the initial stage.
Sure.
That's perturbative by definition
absolutely.
Because it's slow. So that tells you that your theory has to somehow find a way to readjust itself.
Absolutely.
And it makes it, you know, look like a perturbation process. But, you know, I don't know how it does that. Mm-hmm.
That's a good question, yeah.
Is that inflation in this theory?
Yes, that's actually my next study, which I didn't really want to get into. So I haven't hit inflation because G effective is 1 plus WG, and 1 plus W is not zero inflation. So it could be a small number, but it's not zero. So, and you change things in inflation with maybe order of 2 orders of magnitude, but since the scale of inflation is uncertain by, I don't know, 10 orders of magnitude, it's not really that different. So, for example, MS squared, phi squared still gives you successful predictions.
Maybe you should discuss more details later.
Yeah.
Let's let Rafael ask the last question. And then
just wondering about the potential conflict between the breaking of Lorentz invariants and the original microscopic motivation. So the original motivation was to cancel out this very large particle physics contribution.
Mm-hmm.
And that your cancellation mechanism depends on the fact that it should be proportional to the metric. But if, in fact, at some fundamental level you're going to break by Lorentz invariants, why would you have this proportionality?
Of course, that comes to why does matter only symmetric? That's the question, mm-hmm. even at the classical level. But if it only sees metric, given the quantum
even if in the quantum, yeah, in the quantum, if this is totally just decoupled, even at the quantum level,
then
microscopically,
then you agree.
Then you should be okay.
Okay, so that's really a statement that I have to justify from some means that why does matter only see metric, but gravity sees this fluid.
All right, so let's take the additional.